these were always secret teachings. And so there were always initiations required. And in the wisdom tradition, initiations are not like tests, where you take a test and if you get so much percent, 90%, you're admitted in. Initiations are not that kind of activity. The wisdom tradition always recognized that a duration was the best test. A duration in which nothing happens. Because the Hermetic adage was that students are teachers who are still asleep. And what causes them to sleep is the activity of this world and thinking that that's real. So that someone who is mature spiritually and ready to hear secrets will not experience a long duration of nothing happening as boredom. But they will experience it as a quality of presence. In fact, we should use the gerund form of English and call it presencing. Presencing. And so the initiations were often of very long durations of silence and inactivity, during which those who are still immature, who need excitement, like children or adolescents, get bored and they go away. They do other things. They find all kinds of rationalizations. The Pythagorean communities required 5 years of silence. A 5-year duration in which, during which time, nothing happened for you. And so the quality of wisdom teaching is quite different from a hype. And you can always tell hype because it's always exciting right away. That's the circus barker. That's someone saying, step right up. See the 5,000-year-old wisdom right here. And there are always, in the world, a great number of carnival barkers pretending that they know something. But half of the wisdom tradition is understanding that we don't know anything. Precisely because there's nothing to know. The wisdom tradition is different from a sophistic, exciting guru drawing millions. Planetary TV. But a wisdom teacher who is real understands exactly, precisely, that as much as there is equally that much that is not. Aldous Huxley, in his Perennial Philosophy, characterized these two motions as the via affirmativa and the via negativa. And the via negativa was the acceptance of nothing happening to the point of absorption. And Huxley pointed out that in his experience that Asia very often followed the via negativa of emphasizing that the beginning was where there was not. And in a way, the Egyptian Hermetic tradition is an Asian way of wisdom. It's difficult for us to understand and appreciate how much Alexandria was precisely the meeting of East and West. And the Hermetic tradition, in its Egyptian quality, is Asian, ancient Asia. First and Second Dynasty Egypt, about 3000 BC, is contemporaneous with Sumer and with the origins of the Harappan civilization in India. And all three, India and Mesopotamia and Egypt, were three chords vibrating to the same quality of wisdom understanding 5,000 years ago. What is Western in the Hermetic tradition is the Greek language. The Greek language. Language stylizes the brain and prepares it for a quality known as mind. And mind is always the presencing in the brain. So in a very simple way, the via negativa, it has to do with the mind. And the via affirmativa has to do with the brain. And the brain must respond to this world. But the mind must be responsive to another realm, the realm of that which is not. So the ancient understanding was that, in a way, students who are teachers still asleep, if they are ready to wake up, they will experience the duration of nothing happening as an articulation and not as a hiatus. It's this quality that distinguishes the spiritually mature from those who are simply attracted to the fact that so-and-so has 15 books out, has villas around the world and giving lessons to millions, and all of that is fluff. It has nothing to do with the reality of a wisdom teaching. We come tonight to one of the great Hermetic dialogues. It's called the Key. In Latin, the word for key, clavis, is different from the Greek word for key. Kleis, K-L-E-I-S, Kleis. The Greek language is the Western component. The Egyptian presencing is the Eastern component, so that the Hermetic tradition is a perfect dovetailing of mind presencing within an expressive language. But the insistence from the Western Greek standpoint of maturation is that an expressive language must be spoken by someone. The person must emerge. The sleeper must awake. Because only the person can speak that language from themselves. And if that language is spoken from a presencing mind, then the language is magical. And its consonances. Notice we get the term for certain letters, consonants. It comes from this musical term, which is wisdom, built right into the language, consonances. And there are keys that give a pitch to the consonances, which are called vowels. And so the five vowels, when sounded, are the spectrum of keys which give the pitch to the consonances. And so language itself has a geometry like music. And someone who can speak spiritual language spontaneously from the soul. Well, our little treatise has something to say at the end, and I think you should hear it. Even in poor English translation, it still has the kinetic quality of truth. For man is a being of divine nature. He is comparable not to the other living creatures upon the earth, but to the gods in heaven. Nay, if we are to speak the truth without fear, he who is indeed a man is even above the gods in heaven. Or at any rate, he equals them in power. None of the gods of heaven will ever quit heaven and pass its boundary and come down to earth, but man ascends even to heaven and measures it. And in the Hermetic tradition, it was always the spread figure of the man, whose head and two arms and two legs measure the circumference of the heaven. We're familiar with the Renaissance portrayal of that symbol a la Leonardo da Vinci. A esoteric verbal presentation of it is the sounding of the five vowels. A, I, O, U. None of the gods of heaven will ever quit heaven and pass its boundary and come down to earth. Why? Because they are in a consonance that cannot come to earth. Only one thing comes to earth, and that is before any sound is made, before any key is operative, in the silence of God, his energy comes to earth. But it comes to earth not as anything, but as something which is before being. And the only place in the world where it registers is in the mind of the awakened. God's only temple is in the mind that is awakened. And there, the full power of God is present. Man ascends even to heaven and measures it. And what is more than all besides, he mounts to heaven without quitting the earth. The whole twisted dish rag of ascended masters is a gross misunderstanding of the fact that one's feet are always here, and one's arms measure heaven, and one's head, containing a presencing mind, is even there with God. The entire dimension of the real is present. No one has to even jump one inch. You don't have to ascend even one inch. To think that you did would be a regressive adolescent ignorance. The key, the Hermetic Book 10, says, even in crabbed English, so vast a distance can man put forth his power. And the Greek word for power here is energeia. Energeia. There are two words for power in Greek. One is dynamis, the other is energeia. Dynamis is something that goes around, dynamic. Energeia is something that spreads out. In the Renaissance, when they would show the sun, it would have two different kinds of rays coming out. Dynamic rays, that would be like squiggles, and energy rays. If you look on the back of the original tarot deck, when A.E. Waite and Pamela Brown brought out the tarot deck in Victorian England, on the very back they used to put the Renaissance sun, which is the symbol of the Sforza family, who are the first people to have commissioned artists to make tarot decks. This was back in the late 1300s. Because the understanding was that both the dynamic and the energy are together in presencing, and nowhere else do they occur together. Marc Chagall, in one of his great Hasidic visions, did a painting when he met his second wife, Vava, after Bella had died, and he was distraught and bereft and didn't know whether love ever like that ever came again. And when he received the gift of love again, another woman, he was so joyed, he did a painting called The Creation of Man. And he has the angel of the presence of the Lord, that's how it's talked about in Judaism, carrying the body of Adam into life. And there you see the great spiral of this dynamis and the great radiant lines coming out. For the divine coming into man brings that presencing. So the presencing is like the breath of the eternal. That's how the Upanishads in India talk about it. The breath of the eternal. It gives life. The movement, in Greek it's called kinesis, the movement of life is the dynamic articulated by the energy. And this is what the Hermetic treatise ends with. We must not shrink, then, from saying that a man on earth is a mortal god and that a god in heaven is an immortal man. That's how the treatise ends. It's one of the longest of the Hermetic treatises. Let's come back to the beginning of it. I did a full outline of the entire thing in the pamphlet, in the book, The Ancient Hermetic Writings, and it starts with this illustration. And I went through the entire document so that if you need to, you can just refer to my notes and emendation, you have the whole thing. But I'd like to go over the first two pages. Just the first two pages. This is legitimate wisdom teaching. Not like the last 2 weeks that we've had where there was some impairment due to emendation. Worldly brains are always trying to make things clearer by explaining. When nothing is made clearer by explaining, only acceptance clears up. And one has to learn in a wisdom tradition that the via negativa operates only in acceptance. And that acceptance deepens to what we would call absorption. And absorption brings that deep silence in, not even into existence, because it's there before existence. And that's what the first two pages are all about. Appreciating, not understanding, that there's a certain, I think the English term should be suchness. The term in Sanskrit is tathata, tathata. It means suchness. It doesn't mean existence. When the Buddha spoke of himself, he never called himself a Buddha. That would be very ignorant. He referred to himself as a tathagata, someone whose suchness had gone beyond. And so the ancient Prajnaparamita chant was always gati gati paragati parasangati bodhisvaha. It means that the penetration into absorption and the deep silence presences the divine here. And by that, man measures heaven and includes earth as a consonance of heaven, which is something that the gods and the constellations cannot do. They cannot include this world in the resonance of heaven, but man can. It says in the Epistle to the Hebrews, in the New Testament, man is more important than angels. For to which angel did God ever say, that you are my son. The writer of epistles, Apollos of Alexandria, says man is a part of the divine family. We inherit the house. We don't work there. We inherit it. It's quite different. Let's come to the beginning of the key. Right away we notice in the legitimate Hermetic tradition that there is a dialogue form operative here. And not just a dialogue form, but a kind of a version of the dialogue in Plato's day, or even several generations before Plato, by the time of Aeschylus. In the early 5th century BC, wisdom was the voices working together. And constantly, in the early Greek tragedy, the first Greek tragedy was called the Persians by Aeschylus, about 456 BC. And it's the beginning of this kind of language that you get out of a choir singing antiphonally, and you get voices interacting in this way, and the musical tone is kept in Greek tragedy by the chorus. So that the whole divine quality of language is due to a modulation which the chorus maintains. It's just like a Scottish bagpipe that has the drone key going through. The Greek chorus in Greek tragic language raised Greek language out of the political realm where it had almost always been. The only way that political Greek could talk about spiritual things is in mythology. But by the time of Aeschylus and Sophocles, that language was raised to another notch. A quality and ability for the antiphonal conversation with, instead of the drone of the chorus being there, a kind of a sense of the dynamic movement, the kinesis, of the subject matter. And so in Platonic dialogues, you find Plato's dialogues are a step up from Greek tragedy. It raises that conversation language to another level. Experience it as an articulation. We're just making an articulation right now. Greek tragedy is a very high level. Platonic dialogues are a higher level, and the Hermetic discourse is on a thrice greatest level. So you can imagine the Greek language by the time of Aeschylus and Sophocles, by the time of the old Euripides when he wrote the Bacchae in exile, he left Athens in disgust at the age of 70. By the time the Bacchae was written, Plato was beginning his philosophic career of writing. In Plato's Apology, the first dialogue comes about the time of the last Greek tragedy, the Bacchae by Euripides. And it's almost as if all of the energy of meaning went to the higher level. As soon as there was a Platonic dialogue, as soon as Plato started to write dialogues, the power went out of writing Greek tragedies. And after Euripides' Bacchae, there are no more great Greek tragedies. Why? Because the power went out of the form into another form, the philosophic dialogue. Who wrote the great dramas after Euripides? Plato. And when the Hermetic discourses are written between 90 AD and 130 AD, all of the energy went there out of the dialogue. And you only find hack writers using the dialogue after that. But the cream, those who presenced God in their minds, absorption, and spoke that resonant language of reality, they wrote what we call it in English discourses, but the Greek word is spelled with the letters that spell E-R-M-O-N with an aspirant at the beginning. Usually the aspirant is a silent H. Now, E-R-M-O-N, if you add an S to it at the beginning, is sermon. But E-R-M-O-N, if you add an H, is hermen. And the Greek word for interpretive language is hermeneia. So the Hermetic discourse is midway between a sermon and a hermeneia, an interpretation. Midway between that. It folds language in such a way that on this side is the sermon and on this side is the hermeneia. Or later on, it became possible to see that this was a new form of brain that the mind was engendering. Because whatever style of language you use, the brain must take an appropriate response to. If you speak English, your language centers are about here. If you speak Japanese, they're about here. In different parts of the brain, so the brain responds to language. The whole evolution of our species is all based on language steps. When you only needed a few grunts to get by, 400 cubic centimeters of brain was enough to get by for everything. And as soon as sounds began to be articulated, the cc, the cubic centimeter capacity of the brain, goes up. So we have today about 1,400. The form of the language changed from a scroll to folded planes gathered together that made a new kind of book. Instead of a scroll, it made a codex. Because it was seen that the hermeneia was on the inside, and you opened up the page. So that the Hermetic tradition, very powerful, it's not some kind of underground secret thing way over here on the side. It's the spinal column of civilization. And that's why its rediscovery made the Renaissance. And that's why the appreciation of its meaning made the Enlightenment. And everyone from Leonardo da Vinci to Thomas Jefferson understood very clearly what this was. It's only in our time, because we live in a junkyard, that it's not known. It's a minority report in terms of history. What we're reading is not a treatise. It's a discourse, it's an ermen, it's a hermeneia, it's a sermon, sermon hermeneia. It is the beginning of the codex of a language which has to be presented in a book form rather than a scroll form. Two generations before the Hermetic sermons, the scroll is still the standard form by which language is conveyed to the mind. The Dead Sea Scrolls are still scrolls. But none of the Hermetic documents are on a scroll. They're all in books. Because this language made the book form. The book in the hand is a consonance of the brain that speaks that magic language and understands it. That's why the Hermetic tradition is the spinal column of civilization. And until someone understands that, there's no way that you can take command and choreograph a life that's really mature. That was what the Renaissance was all about. That's what the Enlightenment was all about. That's what the great age of wisdom in the first century AD was all about. So that the discourse is a dynamic, expressive quality of language that's a step up from the dialogue, which is a dramatic. So the discourse is dynamic, the dialogue is dramatic. The dramatic is already fantastically adapted for symbolic integration, but the discourse is adapted for dynamic differentiation. The dialogue symbolizes and uses a symbolic language, but the discourse is a differential mode that expresses and brings things out. A dialogue is meant to penetrate methodically to the center of the integration of an idea, whereas a discourse is meant to take the center of the idea and pull it out in consciousness and show the coat of many colors. It's different. It's a whole different form. It's the difference between an integration and a differentiation. And of course, the symbol of the two together is an hourglass, symbol of time. So our discourse, our sermon, our hermeneia, begins with Hermes Trismegistus speaking first to Asclepius, and then in the second paragraph, he speaks to Tot. So there are two people there plus Hermes. So there is a triad going on here. And he says, "The teaching which I gave yesterday, Asclepius, I dedicated to you." Now, what dialogue was that? What discourse was that? What hermetic document was that? That was the great Asclepius, the crowning dialogue, the crowning discourse. And so the key is the true sequel. Remember last week we had a second century imitation of a hermetic writing that claimed that it was the sequel to the Asclepius? Not so. The key is the sequel. So that one can say now that there is a great quaternary in the hermetic documents. The first one is the Poimandres. The second great one is the Asclepius. The third is the key. And the fourth one is concerning rebirth. And on that frame, one can come to understand the Hermetic tradition in a very powerful, dynamic way. If one takes the first, the second, the tenth, and the last of the Hermetic treatises, one gets the mind shepherd, the Asclepius. What is Asclepius? Asclepius is the archetypal physician, the healer. The mind shepherd, the physician, the key, the rebirth. And one has in that quaternary the whole mandala of the Hermetic tradition, given in a differential expressive language of the presencing mind consonant with God. He says, "The teaching I gave yesterday, Asclepius, I dedicate it to you, so that it is only right that today I dedicate this to Tot." Now it's interesting here, because this whole dedication, the idea of dedication, is very sacred. That is, that this language is given. Or, if we like to use a dynamic term, it's delivered. Using a religious connotation for the word delivered. Lord, deliver me. It means that the expressive consonance of meaning and understanding comes to one. The deliverance is from someone who speaks the truth. If you know the truth makes you free. Why? Because that consonance itself carries the vibration of freedom with it. And having received it in one's presencing mind, one is free to even measure heaven, if need be. He says, know then, Tat. He's going to dedicate all of this, gifting this language to Tat. Know then, Tat, that God the Father is of one nature with the good. Rather, the working of God the Father is one with the working of the good. Notice the beauty of Hermetic language, that there is an expression of a high order of insight, and then there's a higher order, a refinement of the language that's put just above it. It has a pristine quality. The language comes out of the body, the tongue, the lungs, the larynx, the brain. Language comes out of the body and carries with it the resonant ripple of the body so that its sound, its pitch. But interspersed with the sound, the pitch, with the lungs, the brain, the tongue, the larynx, interspersed with that material quality of vibration is an energy tone. It's like a thrill. And the thrill carries the meaning. So that one has to accept, first of all, by earthly ears and earthly brain, the sound of the language, the sound of the words, and if one accepts it in a whole way, the thrill comes with it. And one gets then the excitement, the beauty, and as the discourse will say, it's this beauty of God. Now, someone who cannot follow that, who cannot hear that, who doesn't have an ear to hear that, will leave the room, not understanding that there's nowhere else to go, not only not on this planet, but in the whole cosmos. There's no other place to go other than the presencing moment. What else is there to do? To file something away? To go buy something? To eat something? Nothing. And it's precisely the nothingness of everything else that is included with the presencing. And that's why the treatise is going to lead us to a recognition that God occurs before being itself happens. And only our deepest silence thrills to that. A silence deeper than our being. And as long as we are clutching at definitions and dimensions of our being, we miss the thrill of it all. We miss the beauty of God, the sublime thusness of God. We're going to take a break in just a minute, but let's bring in a little bit of language. The Greek word for nature here in the Greek text next to it is physis, out of which we get physics, physis. The Greek word for physis means something emerging. It doesn't mean something that's statically there, but emerging. So that nature in Greek connotates automatically a kinetic quality. So that movement, the Greek word kinesis, is always wrapped up with nature. Nature is always moving. But the movement has transformation shifts, which are called changes. It's just like a jazz musician who is playing his improvisation and he's putting the music through its changes. How is he doing that? He's changing keys. He's playing Mary Had a Little Lamb in G, and now he's in D or B flat. He makes some changes. The changes are in the keys. So that when the Hermetic tradition talks about change and movement, it means giving the vowels into the consonants so that the language becomes expressively full. How does it become expressively full? It radiates out the meaning which has been integrated together into the mind. The mind itself is the highest degree of the absorptive moment of acceptance. Acceptance raised to absorption becomes the presencing of the mind. And when that presencing mind shines, that's when that spiritual language comes out. And so the language is not spoken by the tongue or the larynx or the brain or the lungs. The language is spoken by the spirit. The spirit speaks. And you can kinesthetically feel in the body the takeoff when a language is spiritual. That the body itself flies. It flies where? It flies in the mind's kinesis. This is the ascent of the dove. We've heard a lot about the descent of the dove. This is the ascent of the dove. Let's take a little break, and 5 minutes or so, and we'll finish up.